his voice. Qui-Gon, with such a belief that Anakin was the chosen one, whether or not that was true, it was hard to argue with Anakin's accomplishments. His faith would be rewarded. They sat in silence for several seconds, the only sound that of cutlery and plates from far across the dining hall, both of them now silent. Finally, Anakin pushed things forward, as he always did. I really should fly out to Cato Neimoidia, as backup. I don't trust Dooku, or the Trade Federation, or Neimoidians in general, for that matter. That's not within the parameters of the mission, unfortunately. Anakin gave a quiet laugh, then shook his head. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that Jedi Knights really do still follow all the rules? We thought that was something you told the Padawans to keep us in line. Indeed. In fact, I think you'll find that life as a Jedi Knight is much easier when you stick to the rules. Improvising tends to only invite trouble. Speaking of which, Obi-Wan brightened, and suddenly he found himself trying to contain the urge to chuckle. You should have a plan for tomorrow. What is this mystery assignment? It is something far more challenging, far more emotionally taxing than a simple negotiation. But it is a rite of passage, something notched on the belt of every Jedi. Anakin's face crinkled in curiosity, and Obi-Wan knew he had his young companion exactly where he wanted him. You must meet with the younglings and pass on your wisdom. Anakin's laugh echoed through the nearly empty hall, enough that it caught the attention of the group of Padawans in the far corner. Okay. Seriously, what's the assignment? Anakin, Obi-Wan said, placing a hand on his shoulder. I am being completely serious with you. Anakin's eyes grew wide and he began to slowly shake his head. No, you can't be. I'm afraid I am. And this can't just be about lightsaber techniques or physical manipulation of the Force. You must teach them the wisdom you've gathered on your journey from Padawan to the Trials. And? Obi-Wan bit his lip to hold in his laughter. You must answer their questions. All of them.
Chapter 10. Roog Quornom.
No matter how much she showered, Roog felt the accumulated grime of recent days cling to her body, a stench of decay that refused to let go. Hours of inhaling fumes, getting caked in soot and debris, or desperately hoping that some life remained in yet another uncovered body, all made for an endless toil that left a thick film on both her body and mind. She'd washed. The guard station in Zara's capital complex, offering facilities just as ornate as the governmental offices. Yet despite cleaning up, along with a complete change of clothes and a decontamination of her custom armor, her body felt raw, as if the mists of the surface had burned skin away and exposed every nerve. She walked across the top floor hallway by herself, case in each hand. One for the pieces and modules of her rifle, and one for the segments of her custom armor. Roog always took these back to her quarters, not for safety purposes. Every member of the Neimoidian Royal Guard had a secure locker for equipment, but because without them, she simply felt incomplete. Around the corner, an open balcony allowed Cato Neimoidia's breeze to sting her face. She turned, taking a moment. And though her view of the cityscape was high enough that she could see the trailing plumes of smoke from Cata Sura, the flashes immediately below her drew her attention. One story down sat a flat courtyard, a simple outdoor facility for security force training. And in the middle of it knelt Kitar, rifle propped against his shoulder. He fired, muted yellow bursts of training bolts zipping across the space toward training battle droids. The bolts absorbed into their light shields, though each droid deactivated upon impact. All except the last, which started marching faster.
Faster!
Keeta cursed loud enough to echo into the air. Then he stood and approached the remaining droid, rifle up. One shot rang out, then another, then a third, each directly hitting the battle droid. Its body went limp, arms hanging down.
Vatsto!
Keeta let out again, though this time it clearly didn't have to do with any accuracy. Another flurry of bolts flew into the droid, but with its shields deactivated, the training rounds burned dark patches on the droid's outer shell. He fired again and again, the impact knocking that single droid over. Rather than stand down or reload, Keetar flipped the rifle over and started to smash the droid's head with its stock. Chips of alloy broke off, splintering in different directions until Keetar fell onto both knees from frustration or exhaustion or both. Roog understood. She'd been around death and destruction a long, long time. And even still, nothing had come close to Katasura. She dropped her two cases over the ledge, then leapt over herself, twisting to land in a roll that safely carried her momentum forward. The noise caught Kitar's attention, and the young guard looked up.
You know I can teach you to vault like that,
Roog said, neatly stacking her cases on top of each other before approaching her partner.
Might be a better use of your time than target practice.
She pointed at the now headless battle droid, collapsed beside them.
I think you win.
It's not target practice,
Keetar said, almost too soft for her to hear.
Yeah,
she said, planting herself next to him.
I get it. Sometimes you just gotta blast a droid.
She picked up twisted pieces from the battle droid's smashed head.
Or beat the poodoo out of it.
Keetar reached down toward the mess of servos and wiring sticking out of the droid's neck, though he stared off at the mists above the buildings.
I just can't understand it all.
Hey, Roog said, one hand on his shoulder.
You don't have to. That's not your job.
How can you not try to, though?
The rifle fell to the textured training surface, and long green fingers pressed against his closed eyes.
How can anyone justify this?
Those questions demanded answers. Questions without sense, answers without logic, questions with no answers. They came for everyone who engaged with war for the first time. Even for someone who'd felt her own compassion broken apart and rebuilt so many times, Katasura made Roog interrogate what little faith she had left. Except right now, she couldn't let Keetar see her own fragility.
Our job is to help people. You did that today.
Roog squeezed his shoulder, yet Keetar remained motionless, face in hands. She debated going into soldier mode.
On your feet. Treat your weapon with respect.
But a catastrophe of this size meant that every single person in the capital, on the planet, perhaps even in the sector, processed it differently. Roog chose the only thing they could do at a time like this.
Ketone Moidia is counting on us,
she said in a quiet but steady voice. Though it took several seconds, that sentiment seemed to worm its way in, at least enough for Keetar to meet her face to face again, emotions intensifying the color and cracked pupil lines of his eyes. Roog stood, then held a single hand out, and while she waited, she listened to the sounds of other people walking around the government complex, of speeders flying to and from landing platforms, of the planet's intense winds swirling around them. And when he was ready, Keetar took her hand. Roog pulled just enough to boost him up, and though the young man stood taller than she, he seemed as tiny as a newly born Nemoidian in grub form.
You should get some rest, Roog said. We have a lot to do tomorrow. People to help.
Yeah,
Kitar said, face pulled downward. He bent over and picked up the fallen rifle, then slung the strap back over his shoulder.
I mean it. Get some rest.
Kitar grunted an affirmative, though by the time Rug got to her equipment cases, the training droids had powered back up again. Halfway out, she turned to see him returning to an attack posture, the stock of his rifle against his shoulder, while bolts launched just off target. She considered telling him that he should adjust the stock a few centimeters lower for better stability, but chose not to. Instead, she left him to burn off his frustrations, as she considered her own. Armor in one hand, and rifle in the other.
Chapter 11. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
The last time Anakin walked with Obi-Wan to a transport, they had been master and apprentice. Today, though, Anakin seemed like a parent giving their youngling advice before heading to camp for the first time. Except this lecture was about Neimoidian culture. Clearly, he'd spent the evening either at the Jedi Archives or talking to someone who knew just as much about intergalactic relations as Dex. Both options offered a way to avoid thinking about the actual speech he had to deliver to younglings, so perhaps it was a strategic choice. As they approached the landing platform, Anakin's tone took a marked shift. He'd been so focused on details about things like the ruling class only represents a small percentage of a society's culture, and conflict often comes from a failure to listen, that his sudden demeanor change once they got within view of the transport to the shuttle proved surprising.
That thing?
Anakin asked with a completely different tone. He stopped to point at the small craft at the end of the walkway. It wasn't the worst thing Obi-Wan could fly. The transport had probably been in service for about a decade, perhaps during Chancellor Valorum's term. And it had been well cared for, meeting Republic standards for service and maintenance. But it was a far cry from a sleek and combat-ready Jedi starfighter. Obi-Wan detested flying as it was, but at least Jedi starfighters were maneuverable enough to feel like an extension of one's own body. This ship might not even outrun a maintenance droid. To comply with Dooku's requests, no Republic cruisers within the vicinity. No starfighters with attack capabilities. Just, Obi-Wan said, getting me from point A to point B. Anakin shook his head as they resumed their walk. Behind them, a small astromech droid lugged a crate of basic supplies, not just for essential hygiene, but also for investigation. I should be there with you. Now. Perhaps it will be simple this time.
Simple? With the Trade Federation? With Dooku likely hiding nearby? With Neimoidians?
Yes, but Anakin, you're forgetting one key point.
What's that?
He asked, his brow furrowed, likely wondering if there was something from his earlier details that he'd missed.
Whenever it's us, things get complicated. That time with Shakti on Nairan Shiv. That nest of Gundogs. Obi-Wan laughed. Geonosis. Maybe the trick is to separate us, and things will go smoothly.
For once.
For once,
Anakin repeated, his tone lighter, but still carrying the weight of the mission with it.
Anakin.
Obi-Wan let out a quick sigh.
We will have to learn how to handle things on our own. This will be a change for both of us.
You're just upset because you can't have me do the flying.
That may be.
They'd reached the shuttle by now, at least enough that the droid pulled away from them. It maneuvered around them silently, tugging the floating supply crate to the cargo door.
Even still, you have the harder task.
They both stopped, the whir of droid servos filling the space as a specialized inventory arm lifted Obi-Wan's gear into the hold. Around them, clones walked in groups to the larger transports, shouts of yes sir mixed in with random jabs about clankers and scrap.
Across the way, Obi-Wan spied Quinlan Vos shrugging off assistance from a droid as he packed spare parts into his own Jedi starfighter for launch. Vos noticed, tossing his long hair back before shooting over a wink and closing the craft's equipment hatch. "I don't envy you, talking to younglings. I'm just off to stop a war." "I've been studying the Nemoidians," Anakin blurted out, despite Obi-Wan's effort to keep things light. "Clearly, there are more details to understand. I should send you holos at negotiating with them." Pushing boundaries to get his way certainly fit into Anakin's usual approach, but it wasn't like him to do something so academic. This strange appreciation of nuance and methodical details was quite the opposite of his usual preferred approach of aggressive negotiations. Sometimes Obi-Wan had wondered if Anakin purposefully slacked on political studies just to goad the opposition into making the first move so his lightsaber could do the talking. The other point of view was that this change represented a compliment. Perhaps his former apprentice did learn something about the art of negotiation during all their time together. Obi-Wan chose to go with that, quelling the still reflexive instinct to snap at Anakin about knowing his place. "Equals," he reminded himself. He was no longer responsible for molding Anakin. That was the galaxy's job now. "No transmissions. Besides, once I reach Cato Nemoidia, my communications to the Republic will be jammed. Only through official means." The comment caused Obi-Wan to raise an eyebrow, and Anakin reached down to his belt. "Remember this?" Coruscant's sun lit up Anakin from behind, causing Obi-Wan to take a second to squint at the small object in his hand. "Ah, Anakin," he said with a sigh. Of course he remembered that. A modified comlink, one of Ras Bohan's high-encryption long-range models, something Anakin tinkered with on the fly during a mission to Terrace several months before Geonosis. Terrace's nearby sector experienced a constant flood of ion storms to dampen communications, and the only way to boost the signal was sending them through layered data packets. Anakin's engineering proved successful, the result being an inherent encryption for a powerful and secure comlink between the two. "Look, this isn't breaking any rules. You've pledged to avoid any transmissions to the Council." "I'm not on the Council," Anakin said with a shrug. "And you're not supposed to contact Coruscant." "I won't be on Coruscant either. I'm off to oversee medical supplies on Langston. As far as the Trade Federation knows, this could simply be your means of watching, I don't know, the final race of the Fire Mountain Rally in a few days. Tom Torre's attempting a sweep of the regional circuit and..." "Anakin, how much sport did you actually watch as a Padawan?" "Enough to know how to switch the refectory feeds," Anakin said with a knowing grin. "I'm just saying, easy excuses for having a comlink." Obi-Wan supposed he shouldn't have been surprised, and though he'd never say it, he hoped all those unauthorized viewings of the galaxy's biggest races gave some comfort during Anakin's hardest years. "I'll keep that in mind." "But..." Anakin pulled out another object, this one a shiny black case. "With this, you won't have to worry. This case will keep it safe and hidden. It's made from a partial Frick alloy. Might even be tough enough to withstand a lightsaber." "You didn't test it?" The docking bay's light reflected off the case's smooth surface, the dark lines of Frick mixed in with something that probably wasn't quite as expensive. "I've only got one of them. Hold up your thumb." "Where did you get this?" Obi-Wan asked, shaking his head but doing as he was told. The device beeped several seconds after encoding his biometrics. "I have a friend who excels at stealth." Anakin popped the comlink into the case, then touched the side, prompting the case's lid to slide over the comlink. Obi-Wan looked over and around the case as Anakin held it up. It sealed so tightly that it appeared seamless. See? Now no one will be able to tell what it is. Obi-Wan took the thin case, which was a little heavier than it looked, but it could easily stow away among his personal belongings, perhaps even attached to a piece of his equipment as a disguise. Anakin held up the counterpart comlink, a similarly thin device. Just for emergencies. I promise I won't call you or track you. You'll follow all their rules. Such a small object for such a large safety net. And he was right. It did technically follow all the rules. And Obi-Wan could choose to ignore the comlink's existence if he wanted to. There was a certain pragmatism to having options, especially if Anakin kept his word on not checking up on him. All right, Obi-Wan said, putting it in his belt pouch. But no communications from you. I will call you if I need something. Hey, Anakin said, palms up for emphasis. You know me. Several months ago, those few words might have come with resentment or defiance. But here, a cheekiness came through, and the look in Anakin's eye lacked the usual judgment of the past, and instead arrived with a hint of amusement. What would life be without constantly fighting with Anakin? Obi-Wan smiled to himself. It would certainly have fewer headaches. I should go. They stood, eyes locked as a gunship ignited its engines, its rumble loud enough to pause their conversation before it floated off to join its battalion. Goodbye, my young apprentice. He stopped himself before saying apprentice. Behind him, the droid beeped to signal that his things were loaded. Goodbye, my young friend. May the Force be with you. He checked his pouch again to confirm that Anakin's encrypted communicator was safe, then turned to take his leave.
Chapter 12. Anakin Skywalker.
Anakin waved at his former master, but Obi-Wan appeared to be too focused to see it. The shuttle hummed as its systems came to life. Then the docking bay rumbled with the groan and churn of engines activating, all louder and lower than the Republic's battle-ready craft. The shuttle was older, its liftoff process nothing like the smooth jump-in and go of the latest Jedi starfighters. Instead, this shuttle, a transport probably built to hold 5 people and some supplies, tops, growled on the same level as larger troop transports. In the small cockpit window, Obi-Wan sat, his posture straight and both hands on the yoke. The ship hovered, lifting a good 30 meters off the landing pad before rotating and zooming into the sky, its distinctive chug-chug-chug sound gradually disappearing and blending into the never-ending din of Coruscant. Anakin held up his comlink and considered pressing the top button to open the channel, a way to both needle Obi-Wan and verify that it worked. But he put it away, having tested it last night with Padme in the security of her apartment. In fact, last night was all about the mission. It wasn't supposed to be. They'd planned on a quiet night in, simply enjoying the fact that they were in the same place at the same time for another night. But Padme had been in full senatorial mode, and despite Anakin's best attempts to distract her with physical temptations, the bulk of the evening involved understanding the nuances with Nemoidians. As a culture, with the local Cato-Nemoidian government, and with the Trade Federation as a larger entity. Padme's inability to turn it off was something that had already made their early marriage rocky at times. The process of integrating two wholly separate lives and personalities turning out to be a little more surprising than he'd expected, even when they'd isolated themselves on Naboo following the wedding. But he'd complied with her research requests, loading up various articles and texts while she made notes, making him commit key points to memory to pass on to Obi-Wan this morning. Then they indulged themselves. Anakin picked joyriding through Coruscant's lower levels,
Padme picked saving the galaxy through diplomacy. It seemed fitting, though perhaps tonight they might hit a happy medium. Across the way, Anakin saw a pile of junked gunship engine pieces, a stack of them waiting as spare parts or perhaps for scrapping. Maybe a clone technician just forgot them. But he reached out, his mechanical arm up, fingers lightly spread. The very top piston trembled before lifting straight up, and Anakin swept his arm left, then right, then up again, before settling it down. And while the object obeyed his command, it still lagged in both response and precision, like a starfighter's controls with slightly loose wiring. The force flowed through his body, and this arm was part of his body, synthetic or not, but it still didn't feel quite right.
"Can I help you with something, General?"
a clone asked. General? That still didn't make sense to him, given the separation between Jedi and the Grand Army of the Republic. He'd passed trials to become a Jedi Knight, not a military leader. But he figured this was a clone commander, an individual, but still working within the parameters built into his body and mind. Whether they had the ability to move beyond that, time would tell. Though for now he found them remarkably human, in a good way. "No," Anakin said. "Just here to wish a friend well on his mission."
"Understood."
The clone turned around and joined the group lining up at a far transport. All of them identical in their size, voice, and armor, except for distinguishing color trim. Anakin looked back up to the sky that enveloped Obi-Wan. Other shuttles and ships coming and going, while a few light cruisers hovered low enough to be seen. Then he turned around and headed for the exit. He had younglings to deal with and wisdom to pass on, whatever that meant. And then one final night with Padme, hopefully without politics or war. Just husband and wife. Chapter 13. Rug Quornom. Much of the past few days had been spent below the mist. Rug and Kitar down on the surface doing everything from clearing rubble to stopping fires before they reached explosive gas lines to administering emergency medical aid. And though her long history as an operative involved murder, both up close and from afar, nothing ever quite matched the sheer devastation of what she saw in the fallen Katasura district. But the Cato Neimoidian government still functioned, handling the usual business of the local municipality while coordinating with the Trade Federation, and on a public level, the continued posturing with both the Republic and the Separatists. That meant that standard guard shifts still happened, the pair swapping the chaos of the surface for the near quiet of government hallways. During that time, Kitar didn't heed any of Rug's advice on tempering his emotions, particularly now, when he accompanied his duty with long diatribes about the Republic's responsibility for the devastation and how Newt Gunray's splinter faction made sense, given the long history of prejudice in the Republic. Rug's response was to let Kitar get it out of his system. It just went on for so long. "And the Republic?" he said, his harsh whisper having grown into something much more audible. "The Republic does not respect any of our culture. Our people. My parents, they..." "Kitar," Rug asked after what must have been several minutes of a continuous tirade. They stood on opposite sides of the open doorway on simple guard duty, a lifetime away from the endless fires and debris far below, the intricately carved stone walls and exquisite ceiling murals of Zara's capital complex, a stark juxtaposition with the destruction still looping in Rug's memory. But here, at least Kitar's rants, which began to border on nonsensical, distracted her. Down the hall, government officials passed, probably out of earshot from their low conversation.
"Yeah?"
"Did you get any sleep last night?"
Kitar straightened, blinking as he adjusted his weight. He peered down the hallway as an Amuidian and a Mune stopped their conversation and turned to observe.
Right, right, he said,
his voice returning to a volume more fitting for guards standing on duty.
Well? Well, what? Did you get any sleep last night, after those training droids?
Kitar looked down at his boots, a quiet laugh soon growing into a chuckle.
No. You fought even more battle droids, didn't you? Long into the night.
Of course he did. She supposed she should at least commend Kitar on constructively getting out his rage, though doing so clearly left him lacking the faculties of a well-rested, well-nourished royal guardsman of Cato Neimoidia.
I hope you at least cleaned up after smashing any of them,
Rug said, light enough that a smile came with it. Kitar laughed again, shaking his head, a gesture loaded with enough of an apology that Rug decided to call it even. In fact, she laughed too, once again distracting the pair attempting to have a discussion down the hall. At least their shift ended soon.
No more practice droids tonight.
Rug, I want to make a difference, he said, his voice laced with both desperation and defiance.
Okay, look.
Her voice maintained a controlled whisper to not give away the fact that they were chatting instead of performing guard duty.
I'll take you down to the surface in the evening. We'll investigate what we can up close, but only if you get some rest after this shift. Go to your quarters, watch a hollow, have an agaric ale, maybe both. That's an order.
We're equal rank. Your orders don't count.
That's an order from the rank of experience and age.
And concern, for what it was worth. She shot him a raised brow, and his ensuing grin and nod showed that maybe she'd gotten through to her young friend. Then a new voice entered the space from within the room they guarded.
Simply to ensure that everything the Republic does is trustworthy.
Rug's history of missions and training had taught her to pick up all the details that identified a situation. Tone, sounds, environmental factors. Her mind worked in a constant scan, gathering information to know as much about the current situation as possible. That led to a running log of all of the Neimoidian officials and dignitaries in and about, both with typical Trade Federation business and with local handling of the disaster. But this voice was unfamiliar, its oily speech already carrying a different kind of cadence. It was female, hardened and spiteful, a gravel to it despite the dignified words it used.
I am honored to support you during this difficult time, she said, the smallest changes in inflections activating Rug's suspicions.
We appreciate your presence,
Minister Alu Vayam said.
But we have assurances from the Republic that the Jedi is arriving alone. An unarmed shuttle, not a starfighter.
A trick. The guise of diplomacy. The Jedi are known for such deceptions.
Several meters away, Rug saw Kitar tense up, his attention pulled from standard guard duties to this conversation.
Don't forget, Count Dooku used to be one of them. He understands their ways.
Despite the tragedy of recent days, I personally have only had honest experiences with the Jedi.
Then you are a fool, she said,
the harshness of her words echoing throughout the room. The footsteps stopped, all of them hesitating.
The Jedi have convinced the entire galaxy of their righteousness. I see through them. Count Dooku sees through them. We will reveal the truth of what happened here. Tell me, Minister, does the Republic have a history of treating Neimoidians with dignity?
Well, it has been a journey to find the right balance.
Your diplomacy serves you in your role. I hear you are the best orator in the Cato Nemurian government. My role is to speak and recognize truth. And my job is to help you understand where you should focus your interests. The galaxy is listening, Minister. Now, consider what you know of those running the Republic. Do they think your people to be greedy?
Well, greedy may be...
Do they consider them to be cowards?
I don't see what...
Do they recognize your art, your theaters, your music?
The woman asked, each question pushing further into the tone of demand.
Or has it all been swept away, lost in the noise of their propaganda? How much could the Republic actually respect the Trade Federation if their only official interaction is a single consulate office that is hardly used?
With each passing second, Rook saw Kitar react in subtle ways, fists tightening, boots shifting, an exhale of grief.
It has been a challenge at times.
A challenge?
That is one way to look at it.
The woman's voice carried a playful lilt, and if Rue was able to see her, she was sure she'd spot a measure of a grin.
Tell me, who is this emissary of the Jedi?
Master Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Jedi Council.
Rug held up her guard rifle, sliding her hand down to the composite grip to let the light from the inner chamber reflect off the short stub of chromium around the muzzle. She twisted it slightly, then looked at the reflection. There was Alu Vayam, Minister of Defense for the planet, and Feldespar, another local official, one who had been overseeing relief resources. And this new person... Pale skin, a lithe frame, no hair on her head, but cruel lines that appeared to be tattoos framing her mouth and temples. She walked, and under a long cloak, the bottom of her dark skirt swayed out in a way that seemed more functional than decorative.
I look forward to meeting this.
She paused, then looked out at the doorway where Rug and Kitar stood, as if her eyes connected with Rug's through the exact angle of the reflection.
Obi-Wan Kenobi.
The woman's gaze lingered for several seconds, then she broke off from the group, marching directly toward their guard post.
I have overheard someone here expressing frustration with the Republic,
she said as she broke the threshold. She walked a meter out into the hallway, then turned, Ayam and Spar moving to catch up to her. The weight of the woman's look brought a pressure to Rug's senses, and she felt immediately that something about the situation was off. Had this person been here in some order of standard governmental business? A diplomat from the Separatists, a visitor from Trade Federation executives? Everything would have carried a different air. The woman's piercing stare told a completely different story. Rook had met people like her before. People who tried to intimidate with their presence alone. Whatever her game, whatever her intentions, Rook wasn't having any of it.
Guards aren't supposed to engage with passersby during our duty,
she said quickly, meeting the woman's unblinking stare.
It's disruptive.
The side of the woman's lips tipped upward before she made a snap turn, then looked at Kitar.
I appreciate the hard work of loyal guards. My apologies for getting in the way of your tasks. If, however, anyone wishes to discuss the previous transgressions of the Republic...
She let her words trail off before stepping back toward the Nemurian officials. Rug turned to Kitar, who stared straight ahead, but something behind his eyes had changed.
I offer a sympathetic ear, and I will be easy to find.
Rug watched as the woman and the officials walked away, silently cursing them as they departed.
Chapter 14. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan hated flying, but this didn't even really count as flying. Rather than the smooth controls and quick responses of a Jedi starfighter, this shuttle, something so dated that he didn't even know the make and model of it, felt more like nudging a floating box. When he turned the yoke, the shuttle responded a second late. When he boosted the throttle, it accelerated so gradually that no G-forces hit him. But at least the chairs were comfortable. That was one thing it had over Jedi starfighters with their cramped cockpits. Given the front compartment's roomy nature, he'd even brought his storage crate up to the front and examined the various tools to help his investigation. Things to detect chemical compositions, examine blast points, compare the Republic's simulation with up-close evidence. And of course, Anakin's case. He held it up, the smooth dark material gleaming under the colored status lights of the shuttle's interior. Would it take a lightsaber to break through it? It was inconspicuous enough, though, and Obi-Wan opted to adhere it to the bottom of the chemical scanner, something that should easily pass any visual inspection of his belongings. The shuttle's comm screen blinked to indicate an incoming transmission. Finally, Obi-Wan muttered to himself before hitting a button. Dex's scowl appeared on his screen, the bang and clatter of the kitchen behind him.
You have good timing, Dex. I'm just about to land.
Well, you have bad timing. You called during the dinner rush. War is good for the restaurant business, at least on Coruscant. But I have your information, which isn't much other than to say that there hasn't been a lot of chatter about Jaitonay Mordia lately.
Nothing.
Whole system has been clear of bounty hunter activity for a few weeks now. Same with spice runners. Same with...
Dex laughed.
Less savory types.
So this is a purely political situation,
Obi-Wan said with a sigh.
Well, we'll see if negotiations can create a peaceful end to this war.
Further shouts from Wanda came over the audio. Dex glanced over with an annoyed grimace, then turned back to the comm in his small back office.
It might work, which is better than it won't work.
Thanks, Dex. You're very reassuring.
Oh! Have you seen today's big HoloNet news?
No.
Obi-Wan said, dread creeping into his thoughts. I've been focused on mission prep.
I forward it.
Dex reached in and around the cam's view, various beeps and clicks happening.
There you are. Do you see?
On screen appeared Satine Kryze of Mandalore. She stood in front of the cam, making a speech from what appeared to be a balcony in the Mandalorian capital of Sundari. Despite her animated discussion and grand gestures, the audio didn't come through, with the news anchor speaking over the images instead.
Is Mandalore's proclamation of neutrality a truly political middle ground? Or is Satine Kryze's recent speech part of a secret bid to aid the separatist movement? We discuss with our expert panel of analysts next on HoloNet News Tonight.
Obi-Wan tuned out the talking head, though the caption stood out clearly enough. Mandalorian Duchess defies Republic in ongoing war.
I see it, Obi-Wan said softly.
She's recruiting systems to push for neutrality. It's not going to help things.
Obi-Wan had kept tabs on the Duchess as anyone would an old friend, but especially one who rose to power in a political situation as volatile as Mandalore's. Yet most of those updates came in the form of reading summaries of speeches and governmental actions. He rarely saw Satine's face before his eyes, and doing so triggered a wave of emotions he recognized. The urge to dream of a different life, a different galaxy. But as he always did, he let the thought flutter away, evaporating before ever taking root. Still, he found himself shaking his head, long enough that Dex must have noticed, even with the shuttle's dated comm system.
This is different. Mandalore's entire history has been based on warfare. Getting involved would undo all of the Duchess's work to create a new future for her people.
I sense a little bias here. You're telling me that you wouldn't prefer Mandalore to be on your side for this?
Dex cleared his throat.
Or think about it this way. What if...
I don't have time for theoreticals, Dex.
One question, old buddy. How bad would it be if Mandalore joined the Separatists?
Obi-Wan looked at the shuttle's computer. Its estimated remaining travel time to get into orbital range was 23 standard minutes. That's not a concern right now, and we'll address it when it happens. I should go, Dex. I have landing preparations to make.
And I have dinners to cook. Don't get yourself into any trouble, Obi-Wan. Wanda can't fly out there to help you.
Well, then I'll just have to have a cup of Jawa juice with her when I get back.
I'll tell her that. See you when you return, old buddy.
Dex nodded and waved his top left hand. Then the screen blinked off, resuming a display of fuel and speed details. Obi-Wan wanted to meditate. Wanted a clear and level head to prepare for the formalities and negotiations ahead. But based on the flight time remaining, he allotted himself a few minutes to consider Dex's thought experiment. What if Mandalore came to the Republic's aid, and Obi-Wan had to work with Satine? Would that be a greater challenge than Mandalore pledging itself to Dooku? Obi-Wan let thoughts flow through him, dwelling on them enough to process, but without ever stewing on them. Though when he considered what might happen if, of all people, Anakin stumbled upon his history with Satine, he found himself smirking. And he allowed himself to hold on to the briefest moment of amusement.
Chapter 15. Anakin Skywalker.
A vacuum in the Force. Anakin had felt this in recent weeks, random pockets throughout the Jedi Temple, and only the Jedi Temple, with the Force cut off for a mere instant. Like those rare occasions when a patch of air stood perfectly still, despite being surrounded by an outdoor breeze. Those pockets were fleeting, tickling his senses long enough to get his attention before dissipating into the flow of the Force. It had emerged more in the recent weeks, and he'd figured it simply had to do with the turmoil they all felt at the outbreak of the war. So it was quite strange to feel it here, of all places, a small training room in the temple, a place mostly used for Padawans and initiates. He'd arrived a few minutes early, mentally prepping for the challenge of speaking to younglings, and as he walked in, another group bounded out. Younglings across all ages, from ones whose legs stumbled over each other to an older Zabrak girl. They all passed, though Anakin found himself reaching into the Force, trying to make sense of the odd sensation. It echoed a long-lost feeling in himself, touching on something from his own early years when an overwhelming loneliness drove a fury that nearly wedged between him and the Force itself.
Master Skywalker!
One of the younglings shouted, interrupting his contemplation. And then another, and then another, and suddenly he faced a pressure quite unlike anything, his focus returning to the present. the younglings were listening. In fact, their attention seemed so rapt that it only increased the pressure on Anakin to say something brilliant. He'd been able to recall and recite all of the details Padme impressed upon him, informing Obi-Wan about things like Trade Federation governmental structure, Nemoidian cultural quirks, and how to say hello in Pak-Pak. And yet his memory fizzled while trying to speak in front of younglings, the speech he'd prepared completely blanking on him. This turned out to be much more difficult than all the other times he'd been assigned to teach younglings, explaining piloting safety, showing basic lightsaber forms during a training session, even escorting Jedi initiates to Ilum for the gathering. Those were all physical tasks, establishing the basics of Jedi training and culture. But this was personal and complicated. What I learned on the way to becoming a Jedi Knight, Anakin started, visualizing the speech he'd written on a datapad. All of the powers available through the Force, physical miracles, sensory impossibilities, mental alterations, and yet none of those gave him the snap recall for this presentation. He really should have brought that datapad instead of attempting to improvise. 10 younglings in front of him, all eyes trained on him regardless of age or species. "Sorry, let me start again," he said with a half smile. "What I learned on the way to becoming a Jedi Knight. Humility, trust, focus, all of the tenets of the Jedi Order. But most of all, I learned about myself."
"Master?"
"Yes, youngling," Anakin said, pointing at Kath Erangris, the young Mon Calamari girl with a thick white hand up.
"What's Homolti?"
she asked in a squeaky voice. "No, it's humility."
"That's what I said. Homolti."
Wait, he said, palms out. Anakin managed to stifle his frustration, a reminder to himself that he was supposed to be some sort of role model here. Of course, Obi-Wan would have laughed at the idea of him trying to explain humility. "Humility is when you don't think you know everything. I mean, when you know you should ask for help. As in, there's no..." His lips pursed, and he tried to not allow his exasperation to overtake him.
"Can we see your lightsaber? Oh, what color is your lightsaber?"
"I bet it's green."
"Shh, you're supposed to be listening."
"No, it's blue."
Anakin stepped back as the younglings spiraled out of control, their discussion turning into a competition about who had watched more Hollows of Mace Windu showing training moves with his purple lightsaber.
"Whoa, hey, younglings!"
Their collective chatter grew louder and louder, and each time Anakin called for their attention, they stirred themselves into their own conversations like he didn't exist. He sighed, head in hands, and was just thankful that neither Obi-Wan nor Padme was around to see this. The younglings eventually settled on their own, and once a dip occurred in their volume, he seized the moment.
"Younglings, look! Let's save the questions for the end, okay?"
Some of them snapped back to attention, the younger ones lost in their own world. "What I learned on the way to becoming a Jedi Knight," he started again.
"Humility, trust, focus, all of the tenets..."
One of the younglings yawned, throwing Anakin off. Several seconds passed, most eyes locked on him, and in return, Anakin bounced between each of their gazes. Anything he'd planned was completely gone, and instead, he was left with a roomful of younglings and zero words of wisdom to pass along. He'd have to figure out a way. But really, this was what he excelled at on the battlefield. Surely he could handle a speech to younglings.
"I would say it's not what I learned. It's who I learned it from. Across my entire life. When I was young, I had a friend on Tatooine. His name was Kitster."
Anakin paused, thinking of the young boy with shaggy black hair and a confident grin, the endless pranks that he'd either played on Anakin or convinced Anakin to partake in. He took a moment, sending a wish into the Force that Kitster made it off Tatooine as well. He helped me find joy during a difficult upbringing, showed me that we could find something worthwhile in even the barest of sand dunes. My mother! He paused, the echoes of that night on Tatooine still fresh, and Anakin looked over at some passersby to hide his expression. She taught me compassion. She taught me to fix things. She encouraged me to be curious, to want more, to find a way even when the Republic's laws weren't there for her. His memories turned, not to the violent, bloody final moments in the huts of Tusken Raiders, but tucked in bed, the Sun Dragon myth once again playing in his mind. Heart. She was all heart, and she wanted me to feel that way as well, to believe in my heart. My master, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
He's on the council,
one youngling said.
That's right. He's helping out for now.
Anakin left it at that, given that even he didn't fully understand who was rotating in or for how long during the recent chaos. Duty, honesty, hard work. He was a great example of that. See, this is the thing. Every single person you encounter in your life, you can learn from them, even if you only see them from time to time. My friend, Representative Binks. You know Representative Binks from Naboo?
Several of the children nodded.
He walks funny,
one youngling said.
He taught me loyalty and to never judge people.
You say he walks funny, but to him, that's just how Gungans walk. As a Jedi, you'll encounter many different people. During your training, during your missions, politicians, locals.
A smile formed on his face, something that might have given him away in other circumstances.
Royalty. Some of them you'll see again and again, and other times your paths will only cross for the briefest of moments. But you can learn from every one of those encounters, because every being in the galaxy has something to offer. Sometimes, he sucked in a breath. It just takes a little bit of patience to find it.
The room sat quiet, the silence of children waiting for more. One youngling, a Chalhuddin with horns just beginning to sprout, slowly raised their hand.
Master?
Yes?
That's a lot to remember,
they said.
It is, he said, and his laugh was contagious enough to cause the others to join in.
If you can't remember any of that, try this. I had a friend once, his name was Qui-Gon Jinn. You may hear about him from time to time. He was a great wise man. He cared, and he questioned. He once told me, right before one of the biggest moments of my life, to feel, don't think, trust your instincts.
Anakin felt the weight of observation behind him, and he turned to see Mace Windu, taking a quick peek before moving forward, a familiar scowl on his face.
Sometimes things like that, you might already know it, but it helps to have someone you trust give you permission. Understand?
A collective mm-hmm came across the younglings, and relief washed over Anakin. His original speech would have gone on 3 or 4 times longer than his impromptu list of people who'd shifted his life's direction. And yet this seemed like enough. Still, he had time to fill.
All right, he said, arms out. Let's try questions again, one question at a time.
All the younglings raised their hands.
Please?
Thirty minutes and some cheap acrobatic tricks later, the younglings filed out one by one as the long overdue Padawan arrived to gather the initiates. Anakin gave a wave to each one, sometimes followed with a bye or a thank you. The last one exited, and Anakin looked at the chrono on the wall of the small training room. He still had to go to the Chancellor's office for the rescheduled formal introduction of the latest Jedi Knights. Such a task barely blipped in his mind. Many would have found meeting the ruler of the Free Galaxy to be a monumental occasion, but for Anakin, it would be a watered-down version of the occasional breakfasts or walks he'd had with his longtime friend. Did the others even realize that the Chancellor had enjoyed casual conversations with him ever since he arrived on Coruscant? If not, Anakin decided discretion seemed the smarter option. He received enough grief with rumors of the Chosen One spreading around at a time when Padawan competitiveness came out in all kinds of passive-aggressive ways. It didn't matter, really. He knew his friendship with Palpatine was genuine, which meant that Palpatine wouldn't take offense when Anakin barely paid attention during the formalities, because his mind would be elsewhere, on the final night Padme would be on Coruscant. Instead of waiting for the ceremony later, Anakin let his mind indulge right then, wandering into a dream. Not the dreams of sleep, when nightmares and visions often collided, but a waking moment, when possibilities seemed endless. When a night with Padme wouldn't always be a fleeting moment slipping through their fingers. Anakin gave in to the indulgence of the moment, imagining a galaxy beyond that, where he could do everything he was meant to do without any of the restrictions of the Jedi Order. A simple freedom to exist, to do the things Anakin and Padme excelled at, yet free from scrutiny or judgment or limitations that forced them into wearing disguises in Coruscant's underworld. Perhaps someday it would be possible. Someday they'd be able to see each other every day. But for now, the reality of the situation was that they had one night. He blinked, returning to the moment. Now what would they do? Stealth remained critical for two people such as them, and there was the allure of staying in and letting things naturally unfold between them. But spending time out together was such a rare occurrence, something to possibly indulge in if they did indeed have the means and the master. Anakin looked down. One of the younglings back to grab a small bag left behind.
Oh. Hello again.
His mind raced for the most appropriate way to close this out as quickly as possible.
May the Force be with you.
Okay. See you tomorrow.
Right. Uh-huh.
By the time the youngling crossed the threshold, her words registered.
Wait, what do you mean tomorrow?
The mission. We're coming with you.
You must be mistaken,
Anakin said, reminding himself to use a gentle tone and let the youngling down easily.
I'm off to Langston. We're delivering
medical supplies. I know. See you at the shuttle tomorrow.
The youngling turned on her heel, then sprinted off to catch up with her Padawan leader. Anakin took several steps forward past the doorway before stopping. The group of younglings disappeared down the long hallway, leaving Anakin to wonder if Obi-Wan was right. Dealing with younglings was much harder than stopping a war.
Chapter 16. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Despite his various dealings with the Trade Federation over the last decade, including the toothless trials of Newt Gunray, this marked the first time that Obi-Wan stepped onto Cato Ne Moidia's soil. Well, not exactly soil. That remained some distance below him, and instead, Obi-Wan walked out of the shuttle's small loading ramp to a landing platform not unlike those on Coruscant, a long oval connected to a bridge that led into the city itself. On either side, further landing platforms of various sizes sat, from small spaces reserved for governmental use to a large port for commerce traffic,
making this corner of Zara more of a transportation hub than anything else. Despite the functional nature of the space, the surrounding structures represented the ornate aesthetic of Cato Neimoidia, a land bridge arch juxtaposed with rows of towers with intricate carvings up and down their walls. At the oval's lip stood a group of Neimoidian leaders. He recognized Minister Ayam from the other day, though he wasn't sure if the others were local representatives of Cato Neimoidia, or if they belonged to the greater Trade Federation contingent. However, two things were certain. First, Senator Lot Dodd had kept his word and stayed out of it, which made it more likely these were local officials. Second, standing behind them was someone new, someone who didn't seem to fit the picture. He angled his view, moving slightly to avoid drawing attention to his scouting efforts. Certain details clearly stood out, from her pale skin to the intensity of her glare. She waited in a familiar pose, one that Anakin often adopted as his default stance. Legs apart, arms behind the back. But here, the mystery woman clearly held a constant scowl on her face, despite the hood over her head, her focus tracking Obi-Wan from the moment he emerged.
Master Kenobi, welcome, emissary, Ayam said. I'm pleased to make your acquaintance in person.
The sleeve of his long purple robe draped off his outstretched arm as he spoke. High winds kicked up, flapping the sleeve and blowing the tails of his outfit, though his ceremonial headdress remained in place.
Low heating, Obi-Wan said with a slight bow, greeting the Neimoidians with their native pack as a sign of respect. The Republic sends its sympathies and condolences. The tragedy of your people has captured the hearts and minds of many in the Republic, and we will do everything we can to discover the true culprit behind this attack.
A G2 droid scooted by, then beeped a request for permission to go aboard his craft.
That's fine.
He gestured inside, then waited for the droid to come out, carrying his crate of supplies.
I travel light, but I think you will find that I have nothing to hide.
Shall I do the inspection?
The woman asked, finally stepping forward. She pulled the hood off to reveal a hairless head, and her limbs remained obscured by her long cloak.
Whomever you prefer.
Obi-Wan leaned over and pressed the latch to unlock the lid. She brushed past the Neimoidian dignitaries, her shoulder pushing into theirs. Obi-Wan took the opportunity to give her another look and confirm his suspicion. Republic forces had seen her before, identified only as an authority within the Separatist army. A leader of some sort, to be sure, though different from the recent emergence of General Grievous, and unlike any other military commander they'd encountered. Her background, her skills, even her name required further digging. And now the unlikely bonus of this Cato Neimoidia investigation enabled Obi-Wan to see who she was and how much of a threat she might be. The woman walked past him without a word, then knelt down to look at the open crate and reached inside.
Republic credit chips,
she said, holding up the small stack of emergency currency.
The minister will provide you with all of your accommodations. You have no need for currency here, so the local government will safely bank this for you. You will, of course, receive it back with accumulated interest when you leave.
I appreciate the favor.
She dug further and removed each item, giving a visual inspection before setting it back inside. Obi-Wan watched, his own awareness keeping his heart rate and breathing steady while he waited for the inspection to pass. She reached the final item, the chemical scanner with the comlink secretly attached to it.
This is interesting,
the woman said. She stood up, her cloak flowing back down to rest, and she presented the device in front of the gathered Neimoidians.
I've never seen such elaborate plating on a scanning device.
It was custom,
A gift from a friend. Consider it, Obi-Wan said. A bit of a lucky charm. She tapped a finger against the underside where the alloy case attached before coming back to Obi-Wan, holding it up as they met face to face.
It's very pretty. I didn't know Jedi cared for such flamboyant things.
Sentimental value.
A sentimental Jedi.
The woman smiled, the harsh lines of her tattooed face bending in unnatural ways.
I think we'll be friends.
Perhaps you can have it when I'm done with my investigation.
It would be a lovely accessory. And look, it's even my color.
She put the device back into the crate, then clamped the lid shut.
The Jedi is clean,
she announced, her long cloak whipping out to reveal a hint of a skirt underneath as she turned on her heel.
Come, emissary, said Minister Ayam. We will send your belongings to your quarters. The shuttle.
He gestured to a small transport craft on a connected smaller platform, one likely used for city-to-city vehicles,
will take us to the disaster area.
They walked in silence, though Obi-Wan noticed the mystery woman matched his exact pace, stride for stride.
I'm sorry, Obi-Wan said. I didn't catch your name.
Ventress, she said.
Asajj Ventress. A pleasure to finally meet a Jedi. Count Dooku speaks so highly of your order.
They started with the formalities. A basic tour of the government offices and the most notable landmarks of Zara. The brightly lit mix of business and artistry, from the hanging towers below the capital's biggest stone archway to the open-air Grand Theater of Judgment, where trials and debates took place. The cityscape looked truly gilded from the air. Designs and architecture unique to the culture and unlike anything else Obi-Wan had seen in his journeys across the Republic. Elegant and sophisticated in ways far different than, say, Naboo, while still taking advantage of the planet's unique natural wonders. Structures jutting out in directions simply impossible elsewhere. The tour itself was short-lived, and soon they soared through the rolling fog of Cador Na Moidia, a long descent that revealed just how high up the rocky spires of this world were. Though he had watched Hollow showcasing the topography of the planet, none of it did justice to the overwhelming girth. No wonder they had the ability to anchor entire cities.
It's quite majestic, isn't it? Have you ever seen anything like it?
Obi-Wan said, a strategic question to goad the mysterious Ventress into revealing more about herself.
Not in person. I have not either. I've traveled to planets with all forms of environmental oddities, but nothing quite like this.
She shook her head with a breath, then straightened up.
Let's dispense with the pleasantries. You wish to ask me something, Kenobi?
Her direct line of questioning caught Obi-Wan's diplomatic sensibilities off guard. Perhaps that was by design, given her demeanor.
I'm trying to be polite.
Obi-Wan tilted forward in his seat. Around them, the Neimoidians remained silent, though he was certain they listened.
Unless you feel you have something to hide. Something,
Obi-Wan said. Suddenly, all of that experience strategically arguing with Anakin proving fruitful.
That makes you untrustworthy.
Ventress's head tilted as she bit her bottom lip, a huff of amusement coming out, just enough for Obi-Wan to hear. In fact, the other passengers may have missed it.
While my master has great respect for your order, he also understands that it is the political tool of the Republic. If you recall,
she gave a knowing nod,
that is one of the reasons he left it.
She referred to Dooku as master. Was that an intentional representation of hierarchy within the Separatist leadership?
or a slip revealing something further.
Fair point. Because of that, he has sent me to oversee your investigation and interactions with the Nemoidians. She sucked in a breath, holding it as if to tease him. To ensure that there is no evidence of corruption.
Her eyes locked with his, a menacing leer that felt as much a dare as a threat. Fortunately, Obi-Wan had dealt with worse. He did, after all, see Anakin through some very turbulent teenage years.
Well then,
he responded with a tense calm, presenting an equally lengthy pause. Then his tone retreated, going back to the standard diplomat's voice as if he were simply talking to another politician on Coruscant. I look forward to working with you, he added, putting his hand out to shake, in good faith. She looked at his outstretched hand, then back up to read his face. He responded in kind with a polite smile and waited without any movement, like an AI hollow, awaiting input before animating its canned response.
Likewise, she finally said, taking his hand.
The damage was worse than Obi-Wan had expected. They started with an aerial view, constantly circling as the Nemoidian inspector explained the disaster simulation they'd created to get a sense of how the entire structure fell. Speed, angle, tilt, how fires from the initial explosion spread to other areas, the way those fires then weakened other structures prior to impact. And though Ventress presented a cold and unmoving front, he noticed that the air shifted around her when the inspector